We are now recording, and I will mute all, and you have the ability to unmute yourself. So as per usual, if you want to unmute yourself, if you have a question or comment in the middle of it all, feel free to do so. Otherwise, I'll be monitoring the chat window, and I will be pasting in the URLs as we go through the decks. Tonight, I'll be pasting those into the chat window. If you want to pick them up from there, feel free to do so. And with that, I will turn it over to Alan. We're going to cross our fingers that his internet connection remains stable tonight. And Alan, over to you.
I'm going to turn it straight back to Chris because the first slide is a reminder about the survey.
Yeah, okay. So we've this invite to fill out the survey went out to all members at their email address of record in the membership database. So it's primarily aimed towards members. If there are some non-members on the call tonight, if you want to fill it out, please do so. We don't mind getting opinions from other people as well. If you are a non-member, please include that information in one of the comment boxes in there, just saying that you're a non-member. It's not that we don't value your opinion, but we just want to weight it accordingly to whether you're a member or non-member. So if you never got the email inviting you to do so, you can do so at the URL that you see there, and I will paste that into the chat window. So it's tinyurl.com/opcug-survey, all lowercase, and it should take you less than 5 minutes. So encourage everybody to fill it out. We've had good participation, but we could always use more.
Okay, thanks for that reminder, Chris. And as you've probably seen a couple of places, tonight is True Confessions Night. And two of us have made full powers in the last little while, so we're going to own up to it. And I guess we're going to start off with Chris.
Yeah. Okay, so this happened a little while ago, too, where I thought that Universal Plug and Play was no big deal and you didn't have to worry about turning it off. And, of course, it turns out that I was wrong. And on June 2nd, I admitted to the fact that I was wrong and explained in some depth why I was wrong and how people should actually make sure they disable Universal Plug and Play in, I would say, about 99% of all cases. So, restore points. Well, it turns out that I was wrong. And again. So, what are restore points? So, restore points are a way that Microsoft set up so that when you install new software or when an update goes in, a restore point gets installed on your computer, which will allow you to roll back the computer in the event of having a problem. And so usually what it will do is it will remove any drivers that were installed subsequent to the restore point being created, as well as any software that was installed. And not a whole lot more. There is some more stuff that does happen, but that's the primary thing. And so the hope is that if your problems are coming about because of this all of a sudden installation of a new driver or new software, then this will get your computer back into working order. Up until quite recently, I never knew anybody who had restore points actually work for them to restore a system to a working order. It turns out that you can actually have it happen, and some of our members have talked about the fact that they using restore points, they actually did get back to a working order. So for some people it worked, but for me it didn't work. And I didn't know personally anybody who had. But then what came along, the points on the slide here are just talking about the fact that I really thought it was really just a waste of space because it, for everybody I knew, it didn't work. So I checked, and it turned out that on my system, restore points were actually enabled. And I thought, well, I'll fix that later. And so I didn't bother turning it off, and I'm kind of glad I didn't because on July 16th, I was working on my computer, and I happened to right-click on the Start button and choose Computer Management, which normally brings up a Microsoft Management Console, with things where you can look at services and various things like that. Well, it turns out that it popped up saying that an administrator had restricted access to that function. Well, first off, I am an administrator, which it does have a split token, so you're normally running as a user, but you will get that elevated permissions prompt pop up saying that you want to allow this to happen. But with computer management, I never normally even got that. I thought, oh, that's kind of weird. And so I rebooted my computer, and Windows wouldn't load. And it came up with the offer to attempt to restore. So I did it, and it actually did work for me. So it chugged away a little bit, came back. The system rebooted again, went into Windows fine. It did indeed lack the latest Windows update. I don't think there was anything else that I had installed after the latest restore point on my computer. But I reran Windows Update, got the latest update, it worked fine, and I haven't had any problems since. So, yeah, the bottom line on this really is that in the long run, it didn't really matter that much to me because I could have restored my Drive C. I have an image backup that runs once a day. And I wouldn't have lost any important data because my data files are all on different drives. But it was very quick. So restoring from a restore point, it was maybe about 5 minutes, and I was back up and running. So it was much, much faster, and the only thing I lost on it was I had to redo a Windows update. Not a big deal at all. So I'm really glad that I didn't get around to fixing that problem, where I eliminated those useless disk space wasting restore points. And I am now, I guess, a convert to the fact that restore points are actually useful, at least in some cases. So that's my eating crow for the day.
Does that mean I should turn mine back on?
I don't know. I mean, it worked for me, but I mean, I would still say that more people have told me that it doesn't work than have told me it works. Now, maybe Microsoft has done something to make them more reliable. I don't know. So, yeah, they'll end up chewing up a couple of gigabytes of space on your C drive.
I've used it several times successfully when things got strange, usually because of some kind of disk error. But it's good to get back to a kind of sane state.
Yeah. I mean, it's to me, part of it is that it's a no-cost solution other than the lacking of or giving up some disk space. If it doesn't work, then, or if it hadn't worked for me, I would have just gone to my backup. So I don't think anybody should consider restore points to be a substitute for having backups. But it may allow you to much more quickly get back to a working state. So if you're willing to give up a couple of gigs of space on your C drive, then you might find it worthwhile to have that turned on.
Okay, thanks, Chris. So you held your hand up, so I guess I've got to do the same thing. So it turns out I was wrong on one point. And maybe it's not the first time, I don't know. But basically, last week I was talking about a file manager, CX File Explorer, and I blatantly said that it knows about PDF files and it has a built-in PDF viewer. Well, it does have some viewers built in. It has an image viewer, which is what I demonstrated. It also has an audio player and a video player, but it doesn't have a PDF viewer built in. On my smartphone, I actually have a PDF viewer, new PDF installed. So when File Explorer finds a PDF file and I double click on it to launch it, it's new PDF that launches and displays the file. However, it's a neat little program. It's a neat little program if you need a PDF viewer for something like a smartphone where you've got a very small screen and maybe you're trying to read the current newsletter, for example. And, I mean, certainly you can, if you've got good eyesight, you can read the page full screen. And if you tap on the right side of the screen, as you might imagine, it basically goes to the next page. And obviously, if you tap on the left side of the screen, it goes to the previous page. But the really neat thing about the way it works is if you can't actually read that tiny text and you zoom the display, so now you zoom the display so you can kind of see the left-hand column on the page, and the font now is fairly reasonable size. But now when you tap on the right side of the screen, what MuPDF does, it moves the display down the column. So you go basically to the bottom of the page, and now you tap on the right side of the screen again to advance, and now it basically goes up and moves across. So you kind of see windows of the page as you advance through the file. And if you get the zoom right, then in this three-column display, you can basically see all three columns one after the other, basically top to bottom, as you would normally read it. Clearly, if you tap on the left side of the screen several times, you basically just reverse that process, so you can navigate the PDF file intuitively, I guess, just by tapping on one side or the other to either go forwards or go backwards. And so it's a really nice little utility, MuPDF. Not very big, but quite powerful. Okay, moving along, a question came in about Windows Game Mode. And this is Stuart. He says he doesn't do any PC gaming, so he's always had this setting turned off. But he's wondering if enabling Game Mode might run other apps more effectively. So would it be useful on a small PC, a low-powered PC that struggles with Zoom, for example, where the Zoom sessions are graphics intensive? Well, I'd never heard of game mode, so if anybody knows anything about this, chip in later. But basically, if you go to settings and choose the gaming option, and then go down to game mode, you will find that there's a toggle, and by default, Windows 10 has game mode set to be on. And if you read the documentation from Microsoft support, it basically says that one of the things it does is to prevent Windows Update kicking in and doing driver installations and restarting your computer while you're in the middle of your game, which probably isn't terribly desirable. But it also helps, it says, helps achieve a more stable frame rate, however, depending on the game and the hardware, I guess. And so that's what it's supposed to do. And if you look on the web, you'll find there are various ideas about whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. A lot of people say that it does actually improve certain games. But now and again, you'll come across a thing which says, no, it's actually really bad. And it causes poor frame rates. It causes stuttering on the game and actually freezing of various frames. So, I don't know whether anybody on the call here has any experience with this. I guess intuitively, if this thing is improving game performance, it only works when games are running. So the software must be looking at applications as they're being opened and as they're running and deciding whether they're a game or not and whether it should take some kind of action. So clearly there's some kind of overhead involved in having game mode turned on. How much it is I don't know. I suspect it's very minor. And it probably doesn't improve performance very much to turn it off. But clearly, if there are problems, then I guess you should turn it off. Nobody's kicked in on the chat window, so maybe nobody has any clue that game mode even exists. Like me, I didn't know it existed.
Yeah, one of the things I think is, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, my understanding is that it is usually on by default.
It definitely is on by default.
Yeah, so it's probably something that people should be aware of at least. And if you seem to be having any performance issues, it's probably worth trying reversing it and just seeing what happens.
Yeah, I suspect that's right. It's a trial by error type issue. Yeah. Anyway, if anybody has any thoughts, drop them in the chat or send us an email and we'll always come back to it. So moving along, the next question is for Chris.
Yeah, okay. So this came into the suggestion box email address, and it was about Wi-Fi extenders and asking, are they secure and are they safe and are they economical? And they were saying a secondary question to it and more talking on the security side, they were asking, on a Wi-Fi extender, what should you set the security to? And they were asking, should you suggest WPA2 PSK AES, which is Wi-Fi Protected Access version 2, pre-shared key, advanced encryption standard for the encryption, or WPA PSK TCAP, which is an older version of the encryption, and that's temporal key integrity protocol, or a lot of them now offer WPA2, so Wi-Fi Protected Access 2, version 2, pre-shared key, which just means that all the devices have to use the same password or whatever encryption key. And then it will use either AES or TCAP depending on the capability of the devices. So hit the next there once. So are Wi-Fi extenders safe and economical? I think they're safe if they are set up with reasonable security. Economical? Probably. It's going to be cheaper than buying a Wi-Fi router in most cases if you had to extend your network further. So probably economical, but it probably bears verifying that in any particular instance as well. Next. So what's best for security? WEP, wired equivalent privacy. It's kind of a joke that these people who named this originally thought that the security provided by WEP was actually the equivalent of being on a wired connection. And absolutely not. And I say add about 100 exclamation marks to that no. Never use WEP. It has been cracked probably about 15, 20 years ago. It can be cracked in a matter of seconds by anybody sniffing the traffic with an appropriate attack tool. So that's an absolute joke. So WPA2 PSK AES, yes, definitely. That's the sort of gold standard right now. So Wi-Fi protected access level 2 with the pre-shared key and using the best encryption right now on Wi-Fi is AES, so the advanced encryption standard. The next one, okay. TCAP, there's been some attacks that have been done against TCAP, which are more theoretical than practical. Eventually, TCAP will probably be compromised and probably be compromised sooner than AES is. But right now, TCAP is actually still considered to be an okay protocol for encryption. And the last one, I say okay, but I actually prefer not to use that. I like to know what's going on my network. And so I don't want it to decide on any particular connection, is it going to use AES or is it going to use TCAP for the encryption? Most devices nowadays can use AES. I wouldn't want it that for some weird reason that it decided to use TCAP with one of the connections that actually had AES capabilities. So I tend to force it to AES whenever I can, and then if something can't connect, then I'll back it down. But I've in current sort of devices that are out there and operating systems and so forth, I don't run into devices that can't use AES. So I typically force it just AES rather than doing that AES plus TCAP. But it's okay, I think, at this point in time. So do you have a choice when it comes to security on it? And I assumed, and this is not a good thing to assume things. This leads to nights like tonight when we have to do a true confessions. I assumed that you had to use the same SSID and the security for all your devices, for your router as well as your Wi-Fi extender. And because this was another part of this question was, do you really have a choice in what you use for the security? Now, I originally did assume that you had to do it the same as what was in your Wi-Fi router. So if your Wi-Fi router was set to use WPA2 with AES, then your extender had to use the same thing. And you use the same SSID or name of the network. Does anybody know for sure if that's the case? Because I did some reading afterwards, and there were some allusions to the idea that you could actually use a different SSID, and you could actually use different security. But I'm not sure if you can do it, whether there's a real benefit to that or not. Does anybody want to chime in on what their thoughts are? I can tell you why I think that it's probably best to leave it where it uses the same SSID and security. First off, SSID. So if you're thinking about using an extender, you probably want it that if you have a laptop computer, for example, and you're in one corner of your house and you happen to be connected to your router, and then you pick up your laptop and you walk across to the other side of the house and you lose the connection with the router and your extender picks up. It can pick it up automatically. If it's the same SSID, it'll just sort of transparently convert over to it. It can only do that if the security is the same, because it's going to look and say, okay, my SSID is my home. And if I have a different security on my extender, I go over and it says, oh, I see my home. I know that one. And it tries to connect, and the security is different. So it's going to say, well, this isn't the same network. And so it's not going to connect transparently. Likewise, if it's a different SSID on it, you drop one connection, it typically won't automatically connect to another network. It'll automatically connect to at least one, but I don't think it will automatically connect to the other one. I'm not sure about that, though.
The comment in the chat window from Bill in London, he's using Bell extenders. And he says that the extenders use the same as the router settings.
That's what I had always assumed was the case. And I think it's the easiest for your computer to sort of figure out, it doesn't really care which device that it connects to, whether it's the extender or whether it connects to the router. So I think it's the easiest way to do it, but there are possibilities, I suppose, that you could end up with specifically choosing to have a different SSID or a different security mode, if you really wanted to, between your Wi-Fi and any extenders that you have. But yeah.
Tom is saying that his router has the option to reset keys on a schedule. The default is 24 hours. He's asking, is 1 hour better?
Yeah. Oh, well, it's a lower number, so it must be worse, right? I'm being facetious. The idea behind the encryption keys rotating periodically is that an attacker can never sniff enough of the traffic to be able to reverse engineer the encryption key. And so by the time that they could actually sniff enough traffic to do that, the encryption key has changed anyways. My understanding is that TKIP and AES, 1 hour is plenty short enough a time that you don't have to worry about somebody being able to crack your encryption, within that time frame. Will things get, worse that you actually do have to change the encryption key more often than 24 hours? Maybe. But every router I've seen, I think it defaults to 24 hours. I thought they defaulted to 1 hour, actually. Interesting that you have one defaulting to 24, because I thought most of them defaulted to 1 hour.
So I had to change it to 1 hour.
Okay, that's interesting. I don't think that having it at 24 hours is a problem, but I don't think it's a problem being at 1 hour either. So I don't think it really matters an awful lot one way or the other. In theory, 1 hour would be a better setting, but I think it's pretty theoretical at this point in time from everything that I've read anyways.
It's a TP-Link DSL modem.
Yeah, interesting. Hey, Lawrence just chimed in agreement
Stuart
with me,
asking,
of course. Stuart, yeah. Okay, go ahead with that.
He's saying a mobile should be able to switch between connections. And he says work and home, question mark. Do you want to kick in on that, Stuart? I'm not quite sure what you mean there.
Is that being able to automatically connect, Stuart, so that you know, it just sees the SSID and it'll connect?
Well, you use the example of a laptop in your home.
Yeah.
And you're walking between rooms. Well, if you have an office in the basement and a rec room in the garage or upstairs or somewhere else, and maybe you even have different routers, but your machine is logged into both. I'm really guessing what the heck we're talking about here, because networking is not my expertise. But
well, to me, the whole idea is the automatically connecting to a wireless network. So certainly any one of them, you know, any one of my connections, when I connect, I can say connect automatically in the future. And then if I just turn on my computer, it comes up, it sees the SSID, it connects without prompting me or anything like that. But if I walk out of range of that one, can I have it automatically connect to another one? I don't know. I don't think so. I thought there was only one at any point in time that could be reconnect automatically. But I'm not 100% sure on that.
No, I don't know. I'll keep it simple. I don't know.
Yeah, I have a lot of that. I don't know. Yeah, Lawrence has a comment. He's in agreement on keeping the SSID the same as the extender for the reasons I stated. Personally, didn't believe an extender had the capability of smarts to allow for a separate SSID. And if you want a separate SSID, as he chose to, then a separate Wi-Fi router is a better choice. I would tend to agree with that, but I did read a couple of comments that some people were saying that a particular extender that they had, it had a configurable mode that you could go in and choose to have a separate SSID. But I don't know if this was a really rare item or whether it's relatively common. I just read a couple of comments about that, so I don't know. I think long and short is it really is better to, a lot easier to just stick with the same SSID and security mode. And I think any extender that you find out there, when it walks you through the installation of it, I'd be willing to bet 99% sure that that's what it's going to choose, is to have the same SSID and the same security setting.
Bill is suggesting if you move out of range of your router to another one, you'd likely need a password.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking, is that if it has a different SSID, then you're going to need it could be the same password, but you're going to need a password that fundamentally is treated as a separate entity. I'm just not sure if you will get the automatic connection happen if it's a different SSID. If it's the same SSID, it should just automatically connect to that other wireless access point, whether it's, you know, on the router or whether it's on an extender, I think.
There's a Wi-Fi question here, which is a bit different from Wendy. Wi-Fi blocking that would stop an Arlo camera. Been having car break-ins, and Wendy's and the neighbor's cameras were offline for 2 hours. And we think that the bad guys used a device to get into cars that had remote door locks. Anybody have any insights into that?
Well, with remote door locks, it's important to actually keep them in a some kind of Faraday cage. You can buy these little pouches that will house them and protect them, because people can fake your door opening, closing, starting buttons and take away your car.
Do you talk about the key fob, Tom?
I'm talking about the key fob. So it's always best to do that. I've certainly the let's see, it's RV Lifestyle. The person there had a bunch of stuff stolen from their RV while they were in a restaurant because they were able to fake the key, the things from the key fob to be able to do that. And apparently it matters if the key fob is in the Faraday cage to protect it from any intrusion or faking of it.
Yeah, I think in this case here, it's the concern was more about the security cameras all of a sudden going offline. And I think in that case, I mean, it is just RF signals. So certainly jammers should be able to jam the wireless signals that the camera would be using. So this is presuming the cameras are not hardwired. So if they are on a Wi-Fi connection, then presumably somebody could put up a jamming signal that would interfere with that Wi-Fi signal. So interesting that they thought to do that. And I would guess that that would become more and more common, as especially as security cameras become more common, then the thieves are going to decide that it's in their benefit to bring a Wi-Fi jammer with them while they're stealing the cars or whatever they're doing.
Yeah, another thing with the key fobs as well is that the baddies have scanners that if you get out of your car in a shopping center parking lot and use your key fob to lock the car, for a couple of seconds there, it transmits the unique ID of your car. So with that, they can then go and get into your car and start it up, and especially if it's got a keyless start.
Hey, Bob, Chris, and Alan, this is Wendy. So we think that that's what happened, that they had some kind of a device that was able to do, even though the people were home in their bedrooms, sound asleep, that these people had some kind of a device that they were able to get into the vehicles and probably also brought these jamming devices too, because I have an Arlo, my neighbor has a Ring, and so two different, completely different, you know, cameras, but both running on Wi-Fi, unfortunately not wired cameras. So these guys were professionals. They got into a couple of cars. They were able to take one because it did have the keyless start. So yeah, kind of, yeah, the bad guys are getting pretty crafty here.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And we live in a nice neighborhood, so that's why they were looking at, you know, and I'm not talking about nice like multi-million dollar places, but just nice because of you know, we don't have a lot of stuff going on, so we're kind of like hidden away, and so people were scoping us out. So
yeah, William mentions in the chat that he's heard of that being done as well. So but yeah, kind of hard to do anything about people using a jamming signal. Certainly, you know, being able to put your key into a pouch that will block its radio signals so that they can't pick up that unique code, that's doable. I don't know that for me, it doesn't feel very practical because I want to be able to use my key in that fashion and to have it normally in the pouch and then have to reach for my key to open the car rather than just walking up to the car and touching the door handle to unlock things. I don't know. Giving up some convenience for security, but I guess that's par for the course with security. It's rare that you get additional security without in some level of inconvenience being introduced.
And what Bob said, though, I think I won't lock my vehicle with my key fob. I'll do it with the door.
I do that all the time. I don't know if it makes any difference, but I don't unlock the car with the key fob either. I have to have the key fob with me. So there is a proximity thing for it, but I just can touch the door handle to unlock the key. So I don't use the button on the key fob itself to lock or unlock my car. Stuart suggests leaving a hungry dog in the car. That would probably work, yeah. And Lauren says, as a colleague stated, it can be either secure or easy, but not both. And that's a truth for sure. Bob Harris mentions Wyze cameras have an optional micro SD card, and that would retain the video even if you don't have that wireless connection. And that's a good point. Yeah, if you can have your camera actually do the recording itself, that gets around that particular issue.
Okay, we'll move along. The next question is about a scanner. This was B, has an old ScanJet 6300C scanner, which was being used with a Windows XP machine. If you look for drivers for Windows 10, but found that HP don't support this scanner anymore. However, there are third-party sites that claim to have drivers or applications that would still allow use of the scanner. So the question is it safe to download these third-party drivers, and are they likely to work? So again, if anybody has any thoughts on this, but my thoughts initially were of Chris and I put our heads together on this one, and drivers are pretty low-level software, so they're pretty well down there in the bowels of the operating system. And if you're downloading drivers from sources that are not necessarily trustworthy, then that may not be such a good idea. And so I don't think either Chris or I would be happy about that. However, one of the options is if you have the scanner running on the Windows XP, why not just load XP into a virtual machine under Windows 10? It'll run a bit slower. You run something like VirtualBox. It'll run a bit slower, but for a scanner, you're probably not going to notice the difference. You've already got the XP driver built in. And if you're going to run XP in a virtual machine, and the only purpose is to drive the scanner, you don't need an internet connection, so you don't have any bad guys trying to break into your system. So there's really no security risk for that. So I think that's probably worth a try. It might be, if it works, I would suggest it's a better option than third party drivers. And the other problem with third party stuff is some of them are not free. You actually have to pay real money to buy their product. So again, if anybody has any other thoughts on scanners and how to run old ones, drop something in the chat or send us an email.
I think Alan's
I suggest ViewScan. It's been around for decades, and it does a better job, in fact, than most scanning programs. It can scan each wavelength separately. It does dust removal on negatives, and it's very capable. It does cost money, I believe, beyond beyond a trial period, but it's well recommended. I've put a link in the chat. It's from. I thought I put a link in the chat.
The link hasn't shown up yet.
Oh, Tom, you're muted. And does that actually operate at a driver level, or do you actually need a driver already to be installed and it's just software running on top?
No, I believe it runs at driver level, can handle a whole bunch of scanners, old and new. And it's very intelligent. It was originally in developed to actually handle negatives and a variety of negative scanning hardware that was created for scanning negatives. And it does dust removal and a bunch of other stuff. But it also handles, it's been spread out to handle pretty much every kind of scanner that's ever been available. And you can test it out. You don't have to pay for it first. You can test it out. And so I would suggest, if you have an old scanner, that you want to make use of, I think the price is pretty reasonable, something like $50 or something like that. At any rate, it's been around for decades and people have trusted it. I suggest that it's a good alternative.
Timothy was asking if you have the install disk for the scanner, would it still not work unless they're using 16-bit drivers? That's an iffy thing. I mean, drivers work at such a low level that if you have a driver that was designed for XP or even Windows 7, there's no guarantee that it will actually work with Windows 10. That's one of the reasons why when you go onto a manufacturer's website for a printer, a scanner, or whatever, and you look for updated drivers, that they will have drivers available for different versions of Windows, because they are typically pretty tied to the operating system. So that'll often be an issue for you. And Tom, people are still asking for the link for the software that you were talking about.
Sure, the link is there. It's the guy. It's the guy's name, and it's hamrick.com. And there's a review. I sent a link of a review of it as well. And I believe it handles every scanner, in fact, including probably the one I have here, which is a. Workforce thing. But it's very capable is the impression I get, although I personally, I haven't downloaded it, but I don't think I've used it.
And Justin's saying that Windows supports a lot of old devices, so even if HP doesn't support it, plug the device in and see if Windows 10 can detect it and install a driver for it.
Also, don't forget, Windows 10 has a compatibility mode for programs.
Yeah, so it doesn't for drivers, though.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll move along. And another question, this is actually a question from Tom, which is, I think, is interesting. Has anybody used Windows Subsystem for Linux? And if so, what are you using it for? So that's a question for everybody, because I don't and I haven't and I don't really know much about it. And what it says is that it can let developers run a GNU Linux environment, command tools, utilities, and applications directly on Windows, with no modifications being required, and you don't need the overhead of a traditional virtual machine or a dual boot system.
One of the drawbacks that
you want to run Linux app directly in Windows, it's probably a good deal because you don't have to boot into Linux to do it.
Yeah, one of the big drawbacks that used to be there for WSL was that it could only run command line apps. And so, it is good for a lot of utilities and for administrators. It could be a good godsend because a lot of administrators, because they like to script things, they run command line apps on doing things. And so it'd be really great for that. My understanding is that it may be with the introduction of Windows 11, there will be, or it might even be coming to Windows 10 as well. There's a newer version of WSL coming out that will allow you to run GUI apps as well. So you could run basically any Linux application, whether it's command line or graphical. under the Windows subsystem for Linux. My understanding is that's coming, but I read something about it about a month ago, and I don't know any of the real details about it.
And the link for ViewScan is in the chat window now, courtesy of Bob Gavin. So thanks, Bob. Second question from Tom. PFS Sense Firewall. This is an open source firewall. Is anybody using it with an old PC, a Raspberry Pi, or something else? Again, I don't. So anybody else has any input on that? Put something in the chat or open your microphone and tell us all about it.
Under Windows, unless you have a real need for some level of sophistication in the firewall, quite frankly, the firewall that's been built into Windows since Windows XP Service Pack 3 does exactly what most people want, which is it blocks connections coming into your computer that you did not initiate, and it allows all traffic to go out from your computer without hindering it at all, which is what most people actually want in a firewall. So on the Windows side, I would suggest that just using the, for most people, using the Windows firewall is perfectly adequate. But when you get onto other platforms like Raspberry Pi or whatever, if this is available on different platforms, it might ultimately make sense. But again, I don't know anything about it myself.
My understanding of pfSense is that it does more than the Windows firewall in a variety of areas. First, it sits there in front of any of your IoT devices, including your television, your Blu-ray player, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Secondly, it has a way of preventing any ads from ever approaching any of your devices, so that means that you don't need any special stuff on your browser or your PC to prevent ads. And of course, as well as that kind of the malware sources as well. I mean, I use Quad9 as my DNS for my computer, but for my Internet of Things, for my TV, for my Blu-ray player, I have a, I use, what's it called again? Open DNS, I think it's called, or and it actually prevents a variety of things, but it doesn't prevent all the ads. But pfSense has those things. So that's why I was hoping someone would be using it and tell me all about it.
Maybe it's going to be a follow-up next week. Let's find out. Okay, here's a timely share from Stuart. If anybody is in a zone where fire might be of concern, there is an app available for both Apple and Android smartphones that will give you a whole bunch of information about the risk of fire and the actual fires in progress and that kind of stuff, including Stuart, as you probably know, is based in Shawinigan. There's a Quebec-specific app down here which you can download. And if you take a look at this link to Google Play, FireFringe is the app or one of the apps that does this, and you can see that you get a whole raft of maps of fires that are in progress, how big they are, and how quickly they're progressing, plus a whole bunch of other kinds of details. So if fire is a concern, wherever you are, at your cottage, bot, or whatever, then one of those apps might be a really useful little tool for you.
Natural Resources Canada also, they have a Fire M3 project that maps fires. I knew about it many, many years ago. I presume it's still in effect. So if people are interested, you might check out at nrcan.gc.ca and do a search on Fire M3 from there, you might be able to find some information as well.
Now, there's a question for you, Chris, in the chat. Tim's asking, wouldn't you want a firewall to block outgoing traffic just for the first time for any program?
Ideally, yes. I actually do use a program that allows me to do that. So I use GlassWire, and GlassWire allows that idea where on first connection or first attempted connection, it'll pop up and say, do you want to allow this program to access the internet or not? And you can block or allow it. The thing I really like about GlassWire is that when it pops up with that, it simultaneously submits the program to virustotal.com and will report back usually within a couple of seconds. And if I see that any of whatever the current number is, 50-odd anti-malware engines, if any of them have detected it as malware, I won't allow that program to access the internet. Otherwise, if it comes back with zero, man, that's good enough for me. I'll do it. So, yes, ideally on first time for any program, that gets into a little bit of sophistication with firewall, or you get into annoyances where, you know, it's check. One of the problems, I guess, I see with that is that if you have something pop up and say such and such is trying to access the internet, do you want to allow it? Eventually, you are going to be in a position where you will not know what the right answer is. And I do, in terms of if I use GlassWire, where it's submitted that program to VirusTotal, which checks it out. But without that checking, you know, if it's some new program trying to access the internet, if I started a program right then, maybe I could identify it. Oh, yes, that's the program I just, you know, installed on my computer, and yes, I do want to allow it, but I can virtually guarantee that you will end up with, at some point, some program wants to access the internet, and you will have absolutely no idea whether to say yes or no. And I absolutely hate that when I don't know what I should be doing to allow it or not. And so, and most people, I think, the average user, which is not anybody on this call probably, the average user, probably even more so, is in a position where they're going to get prompts that they don't know how to respond to. So that's the tricky thing about two-way firewalls.
Yeah, there's another annoyance too, Chris. I used to use Zonalon, which was a two-way firewall. Yeah. And it was fine. I mean, it would pop up and say, do you want this thing to work or not? And you could authorize it forever and then it wouldn't bug you again. Yeah. But what it did bug you with was it was a freeware product. And so it always wanted me to update to the pro version. And it just bugs and bugs and bugs until I uninstall it.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm talking about problems. Here's a share from Wayne, who listened to this podcast type, or I guess it's a call-in program, which aired on July the 20th, and it was all about ransomware and what to do about it. And they had a couple of experts on the call and answering questions. And basically, you can replay the whole program. I think it's an hour-long program. If you go to this cbc.ca listen website, then you can replay the program and listen to what was said. One of the interesting things that we noted, link to the Canadian Centre for Cybersecurity, it's a government website, and in particular, one of their pages on cybersecurity at home and in the office and how to secure your devices and networks. And there's a whole raft of information on there. So a lot of this is like corporate type security, but this page in particular seems to be dedicated to the home user. So there may be some really useful information there if people are concerned about computer and network security at home.
I can speak a little bit to the Canadian Center for Cybersecurity. I'm on that site all the time because I'm working with cybersecurity with Natural Resources Canada right now. And this is a branch of the Communication Security Establishment, which are the signal spooks for the federal government. And so a lot of the site has information that is at the level of, trying to safeguard networks of tens or hundreds of thousands of people and so forth. And a lot of the security policy decisions that are made at the federal government level for within the federal government actually comes from advice out of CCCS. They do have a lot of good information about home users, but if you go to the site, don't get too concerned if all of a sudden you're on a page and they're talking about something that sounds like it's like way over your head. It's for big networks and things like that. It's easy to all of a sudden end up on a wrong end of that site. But there is a lot of good home user information. They have stuff about passwords. They have stuff about, home routers and securing things that way, various things like that. So it is a very good site, but it's a multifaceted site by a big measure.
Okay, so that's the end of the prepared deck. We still have a few minutes in our allotted 1 hour. So if anybody has any questions or things that they would like to share, then this is the time. So put your question in the chat window or open your microphone and ask. And there's one question in the chat window, Stuart, before I saw your hand go up.
Okay.
One question in the chat window. Have the OPCV membership survey results been analyzed yet? And the answer is no. The survey is still open for input and will be for a little while longer. We're basically tracking the responses, and every time we ask the question, then there's a jump in the number that respond, and then eventually it flattens out. And when it flattens out and nobody else responds for a while, then we'll probably cut it off, do the analysis, and we will provide everybody with the information.
It'll be in the September newsletter. There will be something about the analysis in the September newsletter.
And we may probably have a heads up in the Q&A session ahead of time. Stuart.
Oh, yes. Which one of my questions was I?
All of them.
Okay. Glassware. Chris, are you using, I assume you're using the paid version.
Yeah, I am. I'm not sure I would pay for it. I write for their newsletter. They put out a monthly newsletter, Cybersecurity News, and I write for that every month. And so they gave me a license. Their paid version is actually a subscription.
Yeah.
And when I first started using Glasswire, it was not a subscription. And I thought it was a good price. It's rather expensive on a subscription basis. Yeah. Now, if you use the free one, it's almost as good. And I'll tell you the difference between the free one and the paid one. The paid one, I mentioned how if a program is trying to access the internet for the first time, I get a pop-up saying this program is trying, and it has some details about it, and it says, do you want to allow it or not? And if you've configured the program correctly, while you're paused at that, it hasn't accessed the internet yet, while it's paused, it is being sent off to VirusTotal being checked, and you get the response back, and then you can say, oh, no, that sounds like that's malicious. I will block it from being able to access the internet. Most malware, one of the first things it does is try to communicate with a command and control server for further instructions or whatever. Or it might be that it's trying to attack others on the internet or whatever. So the big thing is to stop it from being able to access the internet. The free version does the exact same thing, except it doesn't do the blocking. So you will get it. You can get it sent off so that virustotal.com, they analyze it and you get the results back. But by that time, that program has already accessed the internet.
Yeah.
So that's still pretty good. I mean, at least you know immediately that, hey, I better do something about this, but it doesn't do the blocking beforehand.
Yeah. No, I have the free versions on my Windows computer and my smartphone. And I kind of like them both because the graphs are really nice and pretty and cool and very informative. But there's more settings than I know what to do with.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a very good program, but it is rather expensive, I find. So I'm a little bit loath to recommend the paid version to people.
Likewise. But I did want to say, if anybody wanted to try it on Android, I didn't mention it as an app, but it does a terrific breakdown of data usage by all your data or by mobile only or by Wi-Fi only and by program.
Yeah, and over
and
time.
Either on day, week, month, or all time. And it's if you want to know what's chewing up your data.
Yeah, and the Android app is 100% free.
Yeah.
Yeah, they don't have a paid version of the Android app. So I have it installed on my Android phone as well, and I kind of like it that I can tell at a glance for, you know, how much data has actually been used over the month and things like that.
Yeah, I definitely don't leave some apps running all the time because I know now that they're chewing up data like crazy or battery even.
Yeah.
Because of
good point.
Anyway, that was my question. Just one.
And, okay, I don't see any other questions in the comment in the chat windows. Is there any other audible or going into the chat?
One thing for Windows, Windows Firewall Control gives you control over what's going in and out using the regular Windows Firewall. I think I've mentioned it before. I put the link in the chat. It's binisoft.org/WSC.
Tom, check your settings on who you're sending it to. Make sure it says to everyone, because your posts to the chat are not showing up. There we go. Okay. There I see the binisoft.org.
But now you're muted.
Sorry. It depends on where my pointer is when I press the space bar.
Oh, yes.
So it's owned by malwarebytes.com currently, but it originally they bought, I guess, Binisoft, which created it. And it's a very nice interface with the Windows Firewall, both in and out. And not only to manage it, but also to check the logs. I suggest people explore.
Yeah, you showed us that one night, and it does have the ability as well to submit to VirusTotal, which is a really nice feature. I really like that, to be able to validate programs that are trying to access the internet before they get there.
Oh, I have one more request for the group.
Sure.
Before everyone logged in and we actually started, I mentioned to Chris that Zoom now seems to have a whole whack of apps available to it. And none of us know anything about it.
If anybody wants to explore some of them and report at a future Q&A, that'd be great.
Yeah. Somebody with a computer with enough horsepower. More horsepower than mine.
Okay, last call. Going. And we'll let Alan wrap up the final slides.
Yeah, one comment in the chat window. It has been amazing tonight. Lots of great information. And I would echo that. So thank you very much to everyone who sent in questions and shares and have helped in the discussion tonight. I think we've had a whole raft of different kind of topics, and I think it's been really interesting. So hopefully we'll do the same thing next week, July the 28th. As usual, if you have questions or topics that you want to share, if you have answers to things that we post ahead of time, send in the information to suggestion box, and we'll be most happy to include you in the next deck for next Wednesday. So thanks, everybody, for attending, and my internet held up, so I'm happy too. Yeah.
And don't forget, September general meeting with the OPCUG is members' favorite night. I had one person who wondered if this was past presentations that people had thought were their favorite presentations that were being redone. And I said, no, that's not what it's about at all. If you have a favorite app or a service or a hardware device that you want to share a little bit of information with the rest of the group, 10 to 20 minute presentation on it, and we will have real-time voting that night for the best presentation, and that will be for a non-board member available to win it, and you will win a 2 terabyte external hard drive. So great prize. If you have an interest in sharing something about a favorite app, service, or device, I'll send in information to the suggestion box email address, and we will reserve time for you at the September meeting.
And you can even give inaccurate information and do a follow-up the week afterwards.
There you go. We'll have to do these true confessions more often. Thanks a lot, folks. Have a good evening.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Good night.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.